fascinated by his strange behavior, particularly during that transformational period after his father's strokes. I am not a psychologist, so I pulled out my old college texts and talked to some professionals to satisfy my curiosity about how this man, once he obtained unlimited authority and power within his religion, had changed from a quiet behind-the-scenes manipulator into a runaway, destructive locomotive. Warren Jeffs possessed all the outward signs and symptoms of narcissistic personality disorder. But narcissism was the lesser of deeper and more frightening emotional problems. I have dealt with many sociopathic criminals over the course of my career, and I can say that Warren was a sociopath too. He is unable to emotionally bond with people, and with his own feelings paramount, he feels none of the pain he inflicts on others. His feigned love for God and his fellow man were a means to an end, something that he fabricated to gain the trust of his victims and maintain his guise as a man of God. The pain and struggles of other people seemed to bring him great pleasure, and watching his gullible followers willingly suffer at his command gave him a short-lived rush. I would never cease being amazed at the depths of his depravity. As the FLDS case expanded before me over time and evidence mounted concerning the behavior of Warren Jeffs, I began to view him as an evil sexual predator who took satisfaction at exercising power not only over children, but anyone under his control. To the narcissistic sociopath, a sexual experience is not about sex. It's about having complete control over his victims. They satisfy their sick compulsions by preying on vulnerable victims who they feel can most easily be manipulated and are least likely to expose their crimes. Warren needed the FLDS even more than the rebel religion needed a leader. His specialized psychosis was dependent on a unique religious hook that just would not work in the general population. In the outside world, he would never have been able to convince anyone to take him seriously. But with the FLDS predilection for blind religious obedience and submission to authority, he had the willing, captive audience that he needed, like a scientist needs lab rats. They believed everything he said and would do whatever he wanted. Add to that volatile mixture another insidious mental illness for which there is a treatment but no cure. Schizophrenia. It was well known within the FLDS community that some members of the Steed family, the line from Warren's mother, had suffered from the disease. It was not uncommon for voices, which Warren would claim were heavenly beings, to interrupt sermons or meetings. It is highly probable that Warren had picked up the family trait. As the boy grew up, he appeared to be constantly teetering on the brink of either genius or insanity. When he became a man of great power, he also became increasingly irrational. Out of this brew of compounded mental illnesses grew a bizarre phenomenon that Warren termed heavenly sessions, in which he claimed to commune directly with God and also with his dead father, sometimes being transformed into a heavenly being himself. Many members of the flock also would come to believe that Uncle Warren could actually undergo a transformation that allowed him to literally walk and talk with God in the flesh, and then resume his mortal form. These sessions could strike at any time, whether he was resting in bed or just reaching for a doorknob. He would collapse into a trance-like fit of quivering and mumbling, and regularly miss scheduled meetings, or excuse himself from other people, because he could feel a heavenly session coming on. It might pass like a gentle rain shower. Or he might go storming on for hours, apparently sound asleep, but contorting like a dervish. When he awakened from a trance, Warren would pass along what he had learned from the Lord in his usual droning, unemotional voice. The recipients of the edicts would therefore receive very bad news in the belief that it was a wrathful God and not their kind and loving Uncle Warren who was dispensing it. Instructions revealed to him by the Almighty during these sessions were non-negotiable. I spent much of the early summer of 2004 trying to break through the FLDS code of silence, their strong, self-imposed shield of secrecy that kept the rest of the world at bay. I had to throw a very wide net and not rely just upon the apostates in Short Creek, because I didn't want to take the chance that their viewpoint might color my conclusions. Through my independent sources, cops and law enforcement personnel in Utah and Arizona, I was able to find people in outlying communities, so I drove out to see them, looking for insights into the FLDS culture. Even out in the boondocks, the men would suddenly develop amnesia when I approached. Some may have taken young brides themselves, or have been part of some questionable FLDS business scheme in the past. But the main problem was that they believed their salvation would be in jeopardy if they communicated with me, and they were petrified of Warren Jeffs. Most were curious about who I was and what I was doing, but did not want to take the chance of having anything to do with me. I also started talking with merchants and contractors who hired FLDS members, and even they knew little about the people with whom they did business. The church guys would bring their own lunches, stay to themselves, and appoint one member of their group to communicate with the outsiders. Medical personnel, car dealers, and home builders all told me similar stories of the icy separation they felt when dealing with the FLDS. It was even hard to gain the trust of many apostates, and I would have to win them over one at a time through keeping my word and following through on my promises. I was searching for people who might be potential witnesses and might be willing to travel with me up to Salt Lake City to meet with Joanne Suter, where we arranged a hotel suite to conduct interviews and secure affidavits about what they had experienced and knew. It took a lot of persuasion, because they were frightened about who could potentially read their statement, if they had done something wrong themselves, if a family member might chastise them, and how their leaders would react. I discovered that there were very few Ross Chatwins around, people willing to speak their minds. It was during that process that I first met the firebrand dissident Flora Jessup, who was more than willing to talk. Flora drove the FLDS crazy, but not without reason. As they say in the Army, she had earned her stripes. She had two mothers and 27 siblings when she tried to escape the religious web at the age of only 13. She was caught, and an apathetic judge sent her back to the family, which kept her a virtual prisoner for the next 3 years. Not only had Flora personally been persecuted and brutalized by the FLDS theocracy into which she had been born, but her sister Ruby had endured a similar ordeal. Ruby was sealed at the age of 14 to her older stepbrother, Haven Barlow. She was raped by him and almost bled to death before being taken to a hospital emergency room. When Ruby later tried to run away, she also was caught and eventually returned by the Utah Child Protective Services to her so-called husband, the very perpetrator she had originally accused of the horrible rape. Knowing what happened to Ruby pushed Flora to make the decision to become a child abuse activist. Flora finally broke away from her family for good at the age of 16, choosing a rough life in the Gentile world over spending one more minute under the thumb of the FLDS. Eventually, she got her life back in order, and today says she is not a victim, but a survivor. Flora never forgot her experiences within the intolerant church, and she remains outraged by the sense of apathy that is so often displayed by the authorities in Utah and Arizona dealing with the plagues. Detested by many in her family as well as the FLDS leadership, she did not care what they thought. She would take on anyone, anytime, to help a child in need. As a private investigator, I was happy to have her open up to me about her experiences. Her zeal might sometimes lead FLDS apologists to brand her as an over-the-top activist, but Flora had a deep well of knowledge of what the FLDS is capable of doing. In our meetings, she kept worrying that something had happened to Uncle Fred, the former bishop of Short Creek, who was missing. Flora thought that Warren had probably kidnapped and killed him a conclusion that seemed a bit edgy at the time, but would prove in the future to be eerily close to the truth. The idea that lightning rod personalities such as Flora Jessup were talking to a high-powered legal team in Salt Lake City was unsettling to the FLDS church leaders, as it should have been. As we listened to those stories, we understood that we were dealing not just with child abuse, but with downright atrocities. Any evidence or indications of crimes that we might discover during the interviews were reported to the proper authorities, and I was working to raise the awareness of the officials and authorities involved. Politicians and law enforcement agencies are busy people and would occasionally need to be jolted into probing the ongoing atrocities within the FLDS and its hierarchy. So briefing various lawyers became another regular aspect of my job. Alongside the Lost Boys matter, we were also tightening up the Brent Jeffs case, a civil court action in which Warren would be accused of rape and sodomy of a child. We had no powers of arrest, but we hoped that law enforcement would step forward to file and prosecute those charges. But none did. Warren was never charged with those crimes, despite the incredible testimony that would have been available from the victims. Nevertheless, both of our civil cases were strong, and we worked to make them even stronger. Also, on our docket was trying to do something about the corruption within the church-controlled legal structure in Short Creek. To that end, we hoped to expand our targets to include members of the town's crooked justice system, a difficult task because judges and police have a built-in immunity. In all, it was an ambitious undertaking, and the outcome was uncertain, but our clients were dedicated to the task of trying to rectify some of the wrongs that continued to take a toll on their family and friends, and so was I. I returned to Short Creek with another subpoena in hand. Uncle Fred Jessup had been replaced as the Bishop of Short Creek by William E. Timpson. It took a while to figure out, because the name game is kept intentionally muddy in the FLDS as one more obstacle to be faced by anyone trying to figure out the culture. Timpson was his last name by birth, but his mother had been reassigned to a new husband, none other than Uncle Fred Jessup, when Will was already an adult with a family of his own. Not only was Will given that new last name, one of the most common in town, but the surname also was bestowed upon his own numerous children. As a result, Will Timpson Jessup became routinely confused by outsiders with the notorious FLDS spokesman, Willie Jessup. By becoming the bishop, Will also had inherited the position of registered agent for the church's legal entity, which meant that I could now subpoena him. His legal address that was listed with the Utah Department of Commerce was 1065 North Hilldale Avenue, which I knew was within the town's health clinic compound. That meant that serving the subpoena was not going to be easy. Following my earlier visits, the compound, which occupied about two full blocks, had become a securely fenced and guarded area. Because of rugged, mountainous terrain, it was nearly impossible to approach the property from the rear. In front, Hilldale Avenue dead-ended directly in front of the clinic's two big gates attached to a sturdy fence whose hollow vinyl shell had metal bars hidden within. Between the gates was a concrete barrier with an intercom and cameras. Behind that was a guard shack. I felt it would be foolish to try and gain entry on my own, because what would have been a routine process service anywhere else in the United States could turn into an actual physical battle in Short Creek. Any such perceived challenge to priesthood authority is treated as if you just sucker-punched one of their kids. I decided to call for some assistance from another Cedar City private investigator, my old friend Jeff Lehnert. There was no use asking for help from the Short Creek cops, who not only would warn anyone I might be looking for, but probably would actively try to stop me from serving the subpoena. Instead, I notified Washington County Deputy Sheriff Matt Fisher about what I was going to do, so he could be on patrol in the vicinity in case of trouble. Jeff and I observed the clinic from a distance and noted there seemed to be a strict protocol for vehicles entering and leaving the grounds, whether for medical care or for an appointment with the bishop. When a car approached, the guard would view it first through the cameras stationed at the gate and along the perimeter. Once the car was cleared for entrance, the 16-foot-long motorized gate would slowly open just enough to allow the visitor to drive inside. Then the car would stop to prevent any other vehicles from coming in behind it while the gate hummed back into place and shut tight. Getting out was just the reverse. This was extremely tight security for a health clinic that accepted federal funding and was supposed to be open to the public. But any security can be penetrated. The chance came when Jeff and I saw a car getting ready to come out. When the gate opened, Jeff quickly drove up and stopped. I jumped out of the passenger side and ducked through the opening gate as Jeff called Deputy Fisher to alert him that the service was in progress. Before anyone emerged from the guard shack to try and stop me, I made a beeline for the front door of the clinic, surprising a young receptionist wearing a blue pastel dress with a white medical smock over it. The name tag identified her as another one of the Barlows.
"He's not here right now,"
she responded when I asked to see the bishop. I handed her the papers and thanked her for her help while she stammered,
I can't take these."
It was a valid service, and I left the building as fast as I had entered. I had been inside less than 2 minutes, but by the time I came out, two police trucks were at the scene, one of them already in the compound. Out of that truck stepped Sam Johnson, one of the newly hired cops who, livid with anger, told me that I was trespassing. I shot back that I had every legal right to be there serving a subpoena on a registered agent of the church. Then I added, "You know what? It's a misdemeanor for you to interfere with the service of legal process. A Washington County deputy sheriff is outside the gate right now, so I'll talk to you out there." I walked away and yelled at the guy in the guard shack to open up. The gate slid back just enough for me to step outside, with Sam Johnson at my heels, threatening to arrest me. The other cop, Helaman Barlow, had blocked the clinic's entrance with his car to stop Deputy Fisher from coming in to assist. As we stood outside the gate, talking to sort things out, a flurry of papers was flung over the fence by an inside guard. It was the subpoena, fluttering to earth. I got a kick watching Johnson scurry around, picking the pages off the ground, and then try to hand them to me. "I don't want those," I said, trying to hold back a laugh. "You can't serve this here," he replied, turning in a circle as if lost. "I've served them already, and the person named on it can do whatever he wants with them. It's not my business anymore." Frustrated, Johnson slapped the subpoena down on the center dividing post between the gates, where the breeze soon sent the loose papers sailing about again. In July 2004, we sent out a news release to announce a press conference at the state capitol, at which details would be given concerning the filing of a racketeering lawsuit against Warren Jeffs and the FLDS Church. The second thunderclap aimed at the FLDS came only a week later, when we filed another suit on behalf of Brent Jeffs, charging his Uncle Warren with those brutal rapes in the children's bathroom at the Alta Academy. Since the church's beginning, the FLDS fundamentalists have been plagued by legal problems of one sort or another, involving internal power struggles and external issues associated with polygamy and underage marriage practices. The standard response from the FLDS leadership to outside challenges was to raise the religious persecution flag and claim the Gentile world was just trying to defame an unpopular religion. Our assertions were significantly different and more focused. The target was not their religion. This country provides everyone the right to worship as they please. Although our cases would be handled in the civil courts, we were alleging outright criminal activity, and we were going after the prophet himself as the leader of a criminal organization that practiced systemic child abuse. Now, all I had to do was find him. Chapter 16. The Record. At the time Warren Jeffs took over as FLDS leader, his flock was estimated at 10,000 people or more, a huge number for any breakaway sect, but that number is deceptive. The membership cannot be truly measured because their records are kept hidden in hideouts and places of refuge throughout the country. The FLDS exists not only in Arizona, Utah, and hidden colonies across the United States, but also in Canada. After generations of secretive growth, the actual number of members and hidden compounds is unknown. Even most FLDS members don't know how many of them there are. Compounding the problem is the FLDS mistrust and refusal to cooperate with any government entities, including the U.S. Census. Any estimate of precise numbers is no more than a best guess. Despite media reports such as one in the New York Times and the February 2010 cover story in National Geographic magazine, Short Creek is not the orderly, spick-and-span utopia molded by a fastidious, fervently religious colony of quirky little worker bees, as is so often portrayed. Overzealous reporters often fall into the trap of trading editorial control of their piece in exchange for a promised exclusive glimpse of life in the secretive FLDS culture. I know of at least a half dozen of those so-called exclusives that were, in fact, a successful attempt to dupe the media into placing a positive spin on the cult and ignoring the real facts. In fact, both of the twin towns are shabby and continue to deteriorate. The immaculate mansions that belong to the church hierarchy are surrounded by half-finished houses, raw basements covered by crude roofs, and trailers that seem about to topple over. Much of it is nothing more than a run-down trailer park with chickens pecking around fancy pickup trucks. Abject poverty and squalid living conditions are a sad contrast to the unique natural beauty out of which sprouts the most lawless town in America. And yet, despite the down-at-the-heels appearance, it is not a community of cartoonish hillbillies or throwbacks to the 19th century. There is money in the pipeline, plenty of it. It all goes to the profit. For decade upon decade, the FLDS faithful struggled to tame this piece of wild land in hopes of being self-sufficient. Orchards and farms flourished from water that was brought in by irrigation systems they had built. And Warren recently dedicated a bishop's storehouse that could hold 45,000 sacks of potatoes that would be brought in from FLDS farming operations in remote Beryl, Utah. FLDS members own and operate a number of businesses in several states that deal in everything from timber to cattle to motels and that have done double duty as hideouts for Warren and as FLDS rendezvous points. Big FLDS construction companies such as R&W Excavation, Tonto Supply, and Paragon Contractors build public works infrastructure for cities and towns throughout the country and act as subcontractors on other projects. Other smaller, ever-changing FLDS companies are nothing but fly-by-night operations that are suddenly created, get loans for new equipment, then default on the debt, stealing the new gear they had bought in the hope that the finance company will never find it. FLDS members are involved with not only bricks and mortar businesses, but also with modern, specialized production. They have high-tech companies that have a record of doing business in Washington, D.C., developing ideas as sophisticated as top-secret night vision components and experimental smart clothing for soldiers. FLDS businessmen have also made extensive contacts in the legislative branches of government and the Pentagon. Perhaps the most well-known example is the history of Utah Tool and Die, a business founded by Rulon Jeffs in 1968, which grew into Hydropack Incorporated, established in 1976 in West Jordan, Utah, while Rulon Jeffs was on the board of directors. The company found a niche in the lucrative aerospace industry and became the sole subcontractor producing O-rings for the aerospace giant Morton Thiokol. After the space shuttle Challenger blew up, killing all 7 crew members in January 1986, a formal government investigation blamed faulty O-rings for the fiery disaster. Roulon's name was soon removed from the board of Hydropac, but the company maintained its strong FLDS links, and his son Wallace Jeffs took over. Hydropac changed its name to Western Precision and moved to a huge building that was hastily constructed as a United Effort Plan work project in Short Creek in only 30 days. In August 2006, when the FLDS came under pressure from the court seeking UEP assets that had been used to finance the company, Western Precision vanished overnight, moving to Las Vegas. It is now called New Era Manufacturing, Incorporated. Some of the FLDS people are trained as professional grant writers in order to bilk great amounts of cash from federal and state agencies and gain preferential minority treatment on government contracts. Trusted wives are listed as officers of a corporation in order to receive minority preference points for the bidding process. For the FLDS community, success in business is more than just a livelihood and means to support their families. It is a religious calling, and they know all of the angles, which they pursue with great zeal, as if their salvation were dependent on it. Short Creek's water department exists on paper only. The fire department and search and rescue squads have been formally charged with misappropriating taxpayer money to support local businesses and church members, and are still under investigation. It is almost impossible for a building contractor to win a project on which the FLDS is also bidding, because the church membership has such a vast pool of free labor, using their own young kids to bypass minimum wage and tax laws. The companies and the contracts are privately held, but are secretly consecrated to the church to support its massive legal fees and the extravagant lifestyle of the church hierarchy. Even the wages of the boys are donated to the church. Legitimate business and government entities are unwittingly helping maintain the FLDS leaders' lavish lifestyles, supporting illegal underage marriage, and participating in the abandonment and neglect of young boys by doing business with a criminal organization that openly thumbs its nose at the laws which the rest of us live by. Since all of the property and living arrangements in Short Creek were assigned by the United Effort Plan Trust, which was headed by the prophet, the majority of residents literally live there by the will and good graces of their religious monarch. However, the Utah Attorney General stepped in to protect the beneficiaries of the trust in the spring of 2005 and seized control of all its assets. A battle continues to this day by the FLDS, challenging the government's intervention to secure the homes on behalf of all the people in Short Creek, FLDS members, and apostates alike. But the prophet wants the trust back so he can continue to use the people's homes as leverage to compel them to obey the will of God. Many of the large polygamist families exist primarily on government-provided food stamps and other means of public welfare support. As far back as 2002, an Arizona judge characterized Short Creek as a taxpayer emergency. Not much has changed since then, other than the fact that residents have become more experienced and polished in their ability to squeeze money from government treasuries. They willingly take from the federal and state governments they hate and distrust, but they go to extraordinary lengths not to give anything back, claiming that such avoidance is their religious duty. Author John Krakauer would famously observe that FLDS leaders refer to the practice as bleeding the beast. Short Creek has long been a drain on the welfare and educational systems of Utah and Arizona, diverting funds that would otherwise be available for sorely needed services elsewhere in those states. Colorado City routinely comes in on the top 3 cities in Arizona for amounts of money received through Homeland Security grants, and the town receives such high-tech equipment as heat-sensing night vision goggles, costing about $25,000 apiece. If there is a government grant available, the FLDS will find it and take advantage of it. With no housing or upkeep expenses, the locals are free to sink their cash into pricey vehicles, such as the Pligrig trucks, shiny new off-road monsters with dark tinted windows that ordinary construction workers can only dream about. The church permits it because those vehicles can be used in business operations, which, of course, also builds church coffers. Warren Jeffs now had everything he wanted. But as he surveyed his dusty kingdom, he grew agitated. The priesthood record would eventually reveal insights into Jeff's twisted thought processes, showing that the more power he held, the more he feared it was slipping away. He saw rebellion, desertion, apostasy, and the devil at play wherever he turned, and particularly in wicked little Short Creek. He felt pushed by the velocity of the changes he had wrought, and the thing he feared most was a revolution among the people. He was determined to quash any perceived movement before it started. The tool he would use to fight this evil was the priesthood, redefining the term to represent a rather mystic authority that covered whatever he wanted. It was not as if all of the high priests could gather in some holy clubhouse and discuss or vote on things. And the so-called priesthood council, or the council of friends, had withered beneath years of one-man rule. Priesthood originated as a gift from God to be used to bless people's lives, and it meant everything. But now, it was an elastic term defined by Warren, and he was ruthless. Those who were half-hearted would have to prove themselves, and if they failed, they would be removed and lose priesthood. Members were now terrified of somehow screwing up, making Warren angry, and thereby losing the revered status of holding priesthood. If they made a decision on their own, they might be accused of stealing the prophet's authority. By the same token, if they did not act, they might just as easily be in trouble for not showing enough faith. Either choice contained risk, and the FLDS men were constantly begging forgiveness, making it clear that they only wanted to do the prophet's and God's will in all things. Contritely, they willingly bowed to accept any corrections that might be due them. Because Uncle Warren controlled priesthood, loyalty to him was ever more paramount. Back in 1989, Uncle Rulon once was asked to explain the priesthood council and had replied simply, "I am it." Now, Warren was. Even the most devout had reason to feel as if they were standing at the edge of some cliff, with Warren's fingertips pushing gently on their backs. The prophet could dispense blessings or he could retract them. He examined his people constantly and seldom found that they were keeping sweet as required, even while they strove to meet his impossible standards of absolute purity and obedience in all things at all times. To enforce his will, the prophet found a source of willing muscle in the teenage membership of the novice Aaronic priesthood and in the higher-ranking and more mature Melchizedek priesthood. In a normal world, young men would perform routine church functions. Warren seized the opportunity to steer these youngsters into being his snoops among the faithful. They would enter private homes at will and make sure the inhabitants were being obedient to the prophet, had his picture properly displayed on a wall, and were following his edicts, much as Hitler's Nazi youths had spied on their own families. Any indiscretions discovered were reported through the priesthood line of authority all the way up to Warren Jeffs, who would deal with the offenders. To not allow the sons of Helaman, as Warren referred to them, into your home would be considered an act of disobedience and would be dealt with sharply. The prophet insisted that it was all simple missionary work. Only a week after his father passed away in September 2002, Warren stepped into the pulpit at the meeting house for the usual Monday morning session to warn the flock. "The outward signs of evil are among us." Younger people were going to the movies in other towns, buying television sets and listening to rock music. He sternly chastised them. "When you choose to put in that disc or that tape, and the booming music is taking place, you are denying God, and you are participating in devil worship. What he called cowboy music and easy rock were equally pernicious. It grabs hold of you. It puts a beat inside of you. It makes you lose your ability to pray. Books and magazines and flashy clothes were works of the devil, and partaking of such evils set bad examples. Even as he delivered that puritanical lashing, he noted that a lot of his targeted audience, the youth of the community, were not at the service. "Maybe some of them slept in this morning," he said with heavy sarcasm. He did not tolerate, forget, nor forgive such absences. Such behavior signified disobedience. As he was micromanaging every aspect of the lives of the FLDS members, he began to preach that Short Creek was hell-bent and needed stern correction. His hammer already seemed to have fallen everywhere. There would be no flying of the American flag, no sports, no organized get-togethers, dancing, or holidays. Even Christmas was abolished. No one could wear the color red because Warren claimed that to do so would be to mock Christ, who he predicted would return in red robes. No television, no books other than approved scripture, no magazines, and no toys. He seemed intent on erasing all of the happiness and joy from life in order to implement his warped vision of a pure society. And he was just getting started. On October 7th, 2002, one day shy of a month after Rulon died, Warren took the controversial step of marrying seven of his stepmothers, chosen because they were the most compliant with his wishes. The sealing ceremony was held in the room that had once been the office of their late husband. Warren claimed that he had 20 more ready to be sealed to him for their remaining time on Earth, after which they would be reunited with Rulon for eternity. In attendance were Uncle Fred and Wendell Loy Nielsen, who would soon be elevated to fill the first counselor vacancy that had been created when Warren became president. Also present was Warren's brother Isaac, whose duty apparently was to parrot not only the information that Rulon had chosen Warren to succeed him, but also that Rulon had publicly condoned the marriages of the widows. That was important because the FLDS had long believed that Scripture required at least two witnesses to validate decisions of major significance. Warren used himself as one witness and Isaac as the other. Nielsen, a businessman, understood that these sudden unions would not be embraced by everyone in the faith.
"I have a strong feeling that Uncle Warren's life will be in danger," he said.
Then he emphasized the importance of the ceremony which had just been performed, because Rulon was hand-selecting spirits that can come to the earth now, that will be very powerful spirits that will come and live and give themselves to God and grow up without any Gentile traits or influence, being just fully priesthood. Translated, he meant Warren could father perfect children by these women who he had been calling his mother less than a month earlier. With that, Warren Jeffs was sealed for time to Paula Jessup Jeffs, Naomi Jessup Jeffs, Ora Bernice Steed Jeffs, Patricia Keat Jeffs, Catherine Jessup Jeffs, Melinda Johnson Jeffs, and Tamara Steed Jeffs. This was the moment at which the prophet also decided that the time had come to write everything down, expanding on what he had always done in his trusty notebook, but on a grander scale. It was time to record the reign of Warren Steed Jeffs. He would write his own version of history as it occurred. Not only God, but also the deceased Rulon would help him dictate. Warren now claimed to have become his father's living memory. In other words, the dead prophet, Rulon, was still able to regularly communicate his will through the living prophet, Warren. specially selected wives, would be his scribes, and record his decisions and words, keeping the notebooks and computer disks hidden under tight security at all times. His new favored bride, Naomi, was one of the first to take on the task, and by doing so, she would gain significant influence over Warren. So began the elaborate and meandering journal, filled with a careful mixture of fact and fantasy, doctrinal references, and declarations to prove that everything Warren did was proper and for the good of the people and his religion. Much of it was simply gibberish. It was stilted, archaic, and out of whack with truth and reality, the world seen through the eyes of a madman. He would even document the terrible, unrelenting abuse of young girls, in much the same manner as a demented serial killer will take souvenirs of his atrocities from a crime scene in order to continually relive the horrible event. Chapter 17. Whirlwind. Serious problems were bubbling to the surface, one after another, faster and faster, and Warren was discovering that he could not handle it all. The year after his father's death, 2003, would prove to be a terrible year. A few of the women who had escaped the FLDS grasp were breaking their silence, and church secrets began spilling into the Gentile world. Drawing public attention could only spell trouble for the cult. A taste of what was to come surfaced on April 22nd, when Carolyn Jessup ran away. She had been assigned to a top Warren confidant named Merrill Jessup as his fourth wife when she was 18 and he was 50, and had borne 8 children. But with Warren now pushing hard for underage marriages within the FLDS, Carolyn was terrified that her 14-year-old daughter was entering the danger zone, and that her kids would become more fodder for the FLDS abuse mill. So she packed all of them, including a handicapped son, into a broken-down van and sped away from Colorado City in the middle of the night, with $20 in her pocket. She was 35 years old. Women and girls who try to break away from the FLDS are always vigorously pursued, and if caught, they are usually returned to the family from which they had fled. Carolyn Jessup could not expect much help from anyone, particularly the church-run Short Creek police. She knew they would be coming after her, and they did. But this courageous woman somehow beat the odds. "When I first fled, I felt that I had landed on another planet," she would later testify before the United States Senate. "I had only limited exposure to the outside world. I had been brainwashed since birth to believe was evil. My rights to my own life and liberty were taken from me when I was forced to marry Merrill Jessup. I never knew what it meant to be safe." For the prophet, her disappearance was not a huge difficulty in itself, but it fed into his churning imagination as additional evidence that control might be slipping away. At the time, he knew only that Carolyn Jessup had become another enemy. What he did not know was that she was going to tell everything. 4 years later, she published what became a best-selling book, Escape, that offered a shattering portrayal of life within the radical polygamous cult. One important thing for a private investigator to do is just to listen. What are people saying? One story circulating around Short Creek concerned a set of twins born to Ora Jeffs, one of the late Rulon's wives, in April 2003. 7 months after the old man died. That required some fast and fancy cover-up work, because the ailing, wasted Rulon could not possibly have been the father. The newborns were kept out of sight in another location so as not to be noticed by the faithful, who might count the months and notice that the arithmetic of gestation was slightly off. It is not uncommon for FLDS children to receive birth certificates later in life, if at all. And those documents were finally issued for the twins a few months later by the church's doctor, Lloyd Barlow. They only muddled the picture. The supposedly genuine papers claimed the two children were not twins at all, but were born to the same mother, Ora, with Warren listed as the father. The birth dates were a few months apart. the timing adjusted to cover the normal gestation period, but still quite impossible. It was a typical FLDS dodge of fabricating paperwork, especially birth certificates, to cover up whatever was necessary. In May 2003, without asking Warren's permission, the Barlow family unveiled a historical monument, a library, and a museum in Short Creek to house books and artifacts from the historic 1953 raid in which the state of Arizona had sought to crush the FLDS. That government intrusion had famously backfired when the national press had published pictures of children being taken away from their mothers, and public opinion had swung against the state and in favor of the polygamists. The Barlows emphasized the roles of their own ancestors in the historic event, while cutting out the Jeffs. Warren was furious when he discovered what had been done, and he ranted in a meeting that the people of Short Creek were idolatrous and were worshiping their ancestors and a graven image instead of God. He ordered that the artifacts in the museum and library be burned and that the stone monument be smashed. Its dust was scattered to the winds that whipped around the striking red cliffs that overlook Short Creek. The Barlows were enemies. Next, in 2003, came an unexpected source of outside pressure with the publication of Under the Banner of Heaven, A Story of Violent Faith, by John Krakauer, who once had been run out of Short Creek. Banner was an immediate bestseller, although it had almost no impact on the lives of ordinary FLDS members. Since Short Creek residents were not allowed to read books, magazines, or newspapers, watch TV, or listen to the radio, most never even knew that the book had been printed. Church leaders tried to dismiss it as just another example of religious persecution by the world outside, but the story opened an unwanted window through which their private world could be examined. Krakauer was placed high on Warren's ever-expanding list of enemies. He was a nightmare to them, a well-known journalist they could not control. And they were in for a disappointment if they hoped that Krakauer would disappear once the book was finished. A lot of things had happened in the 4 years since his first wild ride through Short Creek, and the author had no intention of walking away from it all. He would later tell me, "After being so closely involved with the tragedies that were occurring continually from within the FLDS community, I found it impossible to turn my back on it. I had made the transition from author to activist. I knew too much." That summer, the state of Utah scored a significant victory against the FLDS by convicting one of the Short Creek cops, Rodney Holm, of bigamy and unlawful sexual activity with a minor. For the first time since the 53 raid, a government had moved against the polygamist religion, but this time, the state had won. Holm had been 32 when he took 16-year-old Ruth Stubbs against her will to be his third wife in 1998. The assigned marriage had been arranged by Uncle Rulon, with Warren by that time lurking close by, and since Holm was more than 10 years older than his underage bride at the time, it was a third-degree felony under Utah law. After having two children and while pregnant with a third, Ruth had escaped, and for a change, the law paid attention and brought charges. "At the age of 16, I was pressured to marry Rodney H. Holm under the rule of the FLDS Church," she would testify later in a child custody case. "Since that time, I have lived in a controlling and abusive environment common in the community. The sister wives were physically and emotionally abusive to both myself and my children. I have scars on my face from one beating. Children were beaten and locked in rooms. On several occasions, younger children would be smothered by one of the mothers until they choked or gasped for air. I was required to work and leave my children with the other 18 in the care of the other two mothers." Holm was found guilty and spent 8 months in a work release program at Purgatory Correctional Facility and 3 years on probation. That sentence appeared to be not much more than a slap on the wrist for a man who had abused a 16-year-old girl, but it was generally in line with a case of statutory rape for someone whose pre-sentencing report showed him to be a first-time offender and a former police officer with an otherwise clean record. His religion, in which such treatment of women and girls was commonplace, was not a factor, although it should have been. Holm had no remorse for the crime he had committed, and the chances that he would repeat the offense were 100%, if called upon by the prophet to do so. Instead, Holm became a hometown hero for taking a hit for God and the prophet. Still, it was a shattering blow for the polygamists. Utah had broken through the threadbare argument of religious freedom to convict an FLDS loyalist of a crime concerning underage marriage. A lot of men in the priesthood suddenly recognized that the threat of legal action was real. Fresh off of that courtroom victory, Utah Attorney General Mark Shurtleff convened a polygamy summit on August 23, 2003, in St. George, assembling government agency representatives from Utah and Arizona to start a serious discussion about crimes that might be taking place within communities that practice polygamy. The Attorney General rattled the prophet with a comment, "I don't mind telling Warren Jeffs that I'm coming after him. We have seen compelling evidence that crimes are being committed, children are being hurt, and taxpayers are footing the bill." A morose and angry Warren Jeffs struck back by declaring that Short Creek, which had for so long been a religious haven for the FLDS, was unworthy of further protection by the priesthood, which was his quasi-religious doublespeak way of saying that he was washing his hands of the place, and he slipped out of public view. He was not quite finished with the town, however, and did not slow his frantic drive to marry off its young girls. Instead, he hastened to do even more and much faster. Warren was ripping through the families of Short Creek, searching for tender daughters who could be given to older men, along with his permission to immediately start having sex with them. The priesthood record painted his perverse goal with shocking clarity in November.
"The Lord is showing me the young girls of this community, those who are pure and righteous, will be taken care of at a younger age. As the government finds out about this, it will bring such a great pressure upon us, upon the families of these girls, upon the girls who are placed in marriage, and I will teach the young people that there is no such thing as an underage priesthood marriage, but that it is a protection for them if they will look at it right. The Lord will have me do this, get more young girls married, not only as a test to the parents, but also to test these people, to see if they will give the prophet up."
It was an ultimate trial of faith. Would they cooperate, or would a disloyal mother or father turn him into the Gentiles? As always, they cooperated without fail. The prophet intended to practice what he preached. When his brother Lyle approached Warren with questions
about Lyle's 16-year-old wife, should he wait until she is of age, so-called, before he goes forward with her and has children? I told him he should live the celestial law now. He didn't get married to not live the law.
Then on November 25th, Warren summoned his staunch ally, Merrill Jessup, to inform him of a new revelation from the Lord, a shocking dream in which wicked men wanted to destroy certain young girls, including Merrill's 13-year-old daughter, Ida. She was in mortal danger. The prophet said that if he stood aside and did nothing, he would be held responsible for the terrible things that would happen to her, kidnapping or even death. Merrill scurried home and fetched the girl back so she could be saved. With her father looking on proudly in a hurried evening ceremony, Warren Jeffs married Ida Violet Jessup in the presence of his henchmen, Uncle Fred and Wendell Nielsen.
"She will be raised up as a daughter and gradually as a wife,"
the prophet promised Merrill. He added an extra comment in his private diary,
"But she looks like a natural wife already."
Being only 13 years old was not going to protect her. Within 2 weeks, Warren would turn 48. The child was almost like a birthday present to himself. The following day, Wednesday, November 26th, spelled the end for Ron Robach, who never knew what hit him. The prophet had a revelation that showed Robach had to be removed from the FLDS. It sent a message to the entire membership. If a ranking confidant like Ron Robach could be summarily axed, then no one was safe. Robach was the father who had been so obedient that he had been dispatched to Canada to fetch back his runaway daughter Vanessa to be blood-atoned, although he had failed in that mission. He was Uncle Rulon's old winemaking and dining buddy and was considered by some to have been the former leader's bodyguard. He had taught at Alta Academy and knew the entire family well. But during the new revelation, Warren discovered a subtle deception of Lucifer had crept into Robach. The prophet designated him a son of perdition, ruling that
Ron Robach and his son John do not hold priesthood, and they are to be sent away, and not be among the people and repent from a distance.
Robach was out, along with John, who had defended his father. All ties were broken. Robach lost his place among the blessed priesthood and was excommunicated. Warren called a special meeting of the FLDS leaders to say that anyone who sympathized with the heartbroken castaway would receive the same treatment. Even generous Uncle Fred, out of fear of being flattened by Warren's momentum, turned his back on Robach and demanded the return of a down payment he had lent Ron to buy a pickup truck. As is usual with FLDS men who were expelled by Warren, Robach genuinely did not understand why he was being booted out of the church and losing his home and family. Warren never explained anything more than to say it was a revelation received from God. When Robach asked his old friends to help him understand the decision, he was shunned. To Warren, questioning the decision proved that Robach was a master deceiver trying to worm his way into the hearts of the people. When Ron tried to confess his sins, the prophet judged that the sinner did not admit to some of the immoral things that the Lord had unveiled. My investigation eventually would show there was more to the story. Some sources told me that Robach's real sin had been catching Warren in bed with a couple of Uncle Rulon's young wives while his crippled father was confined to another room. With the marriages to his stepmothers causing such controversy, Warren did not want Ron to have any sort of political leverage against him. But there was more. Rachel was a daughter of Uncle Rulon and a sister of Warren. She was a troubled creature who daringly sought help from a professional therapist outside of the FLDS, but eventually could not bear the abuse she had suffered and would succumb to a drug overdose that many thought may have been suicide. Upon learning of Rachel's death, Warren slid coldly into one of his pious ramblings about how that was the sort of thing that could happen to women who strayed from the faith. Released from confidentiality by the death of his patient, the therapist finally shared Rachel's story with ex-FLDS family members and friends outside of the church who told it to me. The cause of Rachel's troubles, according to the therapist, was that she had been sexually molested as a child by her father Rulon and by her brother Warren Jeffs. As Rulon's confidant, Ron Robach apparently knew this and kept the abuse she suffered quiet. Connecting the dots, it all made sense. Warren would later admit to having immoral relations with a sister and daughter. He used Robach to demonstrate in the harshest terms that he practiced neither mercy nor forgiveness, even when it came to his most loyal followers, and any protest would only prove that God had discovered his black heart. Later during my investigation, in the summer of 2005, I worked through a contact to set up a possible meeting with Robach. Knowing his background, I was not optimistic, but I had to try. He had the potential to be a very valuable source of information. A deal was arranged. We would go to a restaurant where I would sit on one side while Ron and my contact sat at a table on the other side. If Ron was comfortable with the idea of talking, the contact would wave me over. But the wave never came, and I never made personal contact. Even after being ruined by the FLDS, he could not summon up the courage to speak out against the prophet and the church. The stress of all the negative attention, the sudden awakening of government law enforcement, the relentless threat posed by his enemies, and the requirements of running the entire FLDS all by himself overwhelmed the prophet. Danger lurked everywhere. He expected to be arrested or assassinated, and he routinely prayed for fire from heaven to keep all evil powers and spirits away.
No one knows how many times you have been through this mortality. His stepmother-wife scribe Naomi cooed sweetly to comfort him, after watching him twist and turn in his bed all night, burning within rings of fire. You were foreordained to come back to earth at this time. You are a god.
She always knew what to say, but this time soft words of praise were not enough. He needed a way out from under his mounting problems. Warren was flying blind, relying on an instinct for survival.
I ain't got all the answers, 'cause I ain't been asked all the questions, so don't demand all the answers right now, because all the changes ain't taken place yet, he told his scribe. I am taking it as it comes.
He thought discord was spreading within the FLDS, and had even wormed its way into his own household. Jealousy was breaking out as earlier wives were forced to make room for the new ones, and one even had the audacity to become upset when she discovered him groping and kissing a new wife. None of this slowed down his acquisition of young girls. In a single 8-day span, he zoomed from 25 to 42 new victims in his stable, with still more undergoing religious trainings before being officially corralled. At least one was given a double wedding ring to prove she was married to both Rulon and Warren. Troubles mounted throughout 2003. Legal actions were being filed, less than half of the original congregation in Canada remained, and the law in Arizona and Utah, according to Warren, was telling terrible lies against him. He likened the accusations to a mafia novel because authorities gave their sources pseudonyms to protect their identities, even as Warren himself became more and more like the mafia dons he professed to abhor. He hauled along a full security detail when he shared breakfast with 90 women and children in Cottonwood Park. It was becoming too much for him to handle, and he decided on a unique solution, simply to disappear.
The Lord has directed me to move away,
Warren confided to some wives after a revelation. Scouts were dispatched to seek isolated locations across the nation in which he and those loyal to him could find shelter when the world finally came to an end. In reality, they would be a series of emergency bolt holes in which he could hide from the law. A place in heavy forest about 20 miles outside the little town of Moncos in southwestern Colorado was the first selected, and the first of several parcels of land that had been purchased on July 11, 2003, through an FLDS shell corporation called Sherwood Management, under the guise of being a corporate hunting retreat. The mountainous and thickly wooded terrain reminded Warren of the Grand Family Estate that had been abandoned in Little Cottonwood Canyon when they had all moved to Short Creek. Moncos was given the code name of Refuge 1, or R1, to avoid disclosing its location. Specially chosen work crews were dispatched to start building there in great secrecy, and orders were placed for truckloads of Canadian logs from the FLDS colony up north that would be turned into cabins. The hideout was to be in operation by the last day of November, a tight deadline that Warren promised could be met because angels would work alongside crews, even when they were only putting up sheetrock. After a good deal of work had been put into the Moncos project, another even more attractive possibility was found down in West Texas, a state that was very light on zoning and building restrictions. Texans tended to mind their own business, and the state's marriage laws had not changed since the 19th century. Girls as young as 14 could still legally be married there with the consent of their parents. It looked very promising, An FLDS frontman, David Allred, was authorized to buy 1,371 acres of rural land outside of the town of El Dorado in Schlaker County. Several hundred more acres would be purchased later.
Thanks unto the Lord for his bounteous blessings in acquiring the land in Texas.